I'm Charles Garland, and I joined the BBC to start with to be assistant to Jonathan Miller doing an opera, Mozart's Così fan tutte. Now, in order for me to learn a bit about how television worked, the powers that be thought it was a good idea if they sent me away to check out how things worked on location, and also to spend a week in studio to see how that worked. So my first week I was with Paul Daniels' Magic Show in the studio, and the second week I was on location on a program called Heidi High, and I enjoyed that hugely that week and made friends very quickly with the cast and crew and everybody, who were so lovely. And when I came back to go into the office to do the opera, I found that it was about 6 weeks before we were actually in studio with that. So we worked Monday to Friday, but of course, then everybody packed up Friday lunchtime. So I was living in London. So instead of going home, I went up to Television Centre and went into the studio and just joined in again with everybody, and made myself useful wherever I could. And David Croft said to Roy Gould, "Who is that guy who keeps coming on a Friday and helping out and passing wine round and the hospitality and generally making a nuisance of himself?" He said, "Oh, that's Charles. He came on location for a week." He said, "Oh, I didn't see him much." He said, "Well, mainly because he was making tea for the makeup girls and stuff at 5:30 in the morning." Anyway, so he came across and said, "So where are you from?" And I said, "Well, I grew up in Suffolk, actually." He said, "Oh, I live in Suffolk." I said, "I know. I was at school in Bury St Edmunds." "Oh, really?" he said, and tucked that away in the back of his memory somewhere. Anyway, time went on, and that Heidi High finished, and one thing led to another. Jonathan Miller very kindly negotiated with my boss to get me a permanent contract instead of just a three-monthly one. And I was very fortunate that David Croft then invited me back into his team to work on Hello, Hello, and some more Heidi Highs and things like that. So, yeah, all in all, I just sort of became part of it. So every year there'd be one production or another with Croft and Perry or Croft and Lloyd, and I simply just got my name put forward to go to those, and that was great. I just became part of that team. The rest of the year I was doing other shows and gradually worked my way up the ladder, and fortunately I became producer at the end of Oh Doctor Beeching. So I was, by that time, I was established in the line of alumni, if you like, at the University of Croft. Well, once I'd actually finished Doctor Beeching, they didn't ask for a third series. Completely wrong of them, but they didn't. David retired, and so I had left the BBC by then as well, and then David received a call from the BBC saying they would like to repeat Dad's Army on BBC One, but they were concerned because the duration of Dad's Army varied hugely. Some were 29 minutes, some were 31, 31, 32. And they said that they couldn't cope with that scheduling-wise because, as with everything else in the evenings on BBC and indeed on ITV, you've got the 10 o'clock news and everything has to be back-timed from that. And whatever happens, you are not allowed to miss the first bong of Big Ben. So they asked for them to be reduced in duration to fit a slot. So David Croft agreed with that on condition that the person he nominated would do the actual work on it, and they agreed to that, and that person was me. And so I started on all 77 episodes of Dad's Army and took about a week on each one. So for the next 77 weeks I was spending 2 or 3 days going through VHS and writing down. I devised an edit sheet so that I could write down to the actual frame where we could cut. And very often there were things like an example. in between scenes in Dad's Army, as you know, there's very often a bit of music. So Daisy, beautiful Daisy, nice wartime song. And that could last for 17 or 18 seconds. Well, that was a dead ringer for me because I could take 10 seconds out of that. It didn't spoil anything, just cut it down a bit. And there were various places where there were lengthy shots, or repetitive shots that we could cut down on. I had a sort of ground rule that I would never cut any character out. So even if there was somebody that only said two words, I would never cut them out. However seemingly unimportant it was to the plot, because that would be terribly unfair to do that. So I did that, and I was also very careful not to cut out a line which was back referenced later on. So it was quite complex, because you never, you know, I had to watch each episode probably 25 or 30 times, sometimes more if it was a tricky one, like Something Nasty in the Vault one, something like that, was a complex job. At the same time as that was happening, there was new equipment available in edit suites, something called a DVASC, which was a piece of equipment which went through and cleaned up the pictures. It did that by taking it. Now, as you'll know, but not perhaps everybody knows, that each frame is in two fields, so it's actually there are two bits to each frame. And the DVASC, essentially what it did was, if it found something in one field of the frame that was different from the other field, it replaced it. So if you've got a scratch or something like that, or a flash, camera flash, it was usually just on one field. And so by putting it through this machine, it got rid of that. I remember when I carried on doing lots of other programs afterwards, I remember one episode of Porridge where they were out doing some work in the garden outside the cells. And as we watched it go through, I said, stop a minute, there's something really strange there. We wound back in the edit suite and found that there was one field which was just completely green. I mean, pea green. And it had just, every time it was shown, nobody noticed because it goes through so fast. We were able to remove that field and replace it with the other field of that frame so that it then looked perfect. Now, one or two purists, has to be said, contacted me and showed their displeasure, I think also through the Dad's Army Appreciation Society, that we were doing this work because it was sort of cleaning it up, and they felt that it should be left entirely in its original condition. My answer to that was always that if I was given a Rolls Royce that was 50 years old and there were scratches on it, I would restore it and I would bring it back to its original condition so that people could look at it and say, oh gosh, look at that, it's perfect. So I think what we did was actually quite a good job. And David Croft said he felt that I should have some kind of recognition for all this 77 days of weeks of work, and so suggested that I put a credit on saying series editor at the end of each episode, which the very clever editor Steve Jameson managed to create a series editor Charles Garland credit, which went underneath the designer, which he made look identical to all the other credits, which was very kind of David and very kind of Steve to go to all that trouble. And so out went the 77 episodes with series editor on. What happened next was that the BBC decided that repeats like Dad's Army should go over to BBC Two. And this is where it gets slightly complicated, because BBC One wouldn't let BBC Two have the new versions, because they said, no, those have been paid for out of our budget, so those are our version. Which, I know, it's a bit crazy. It's a bit like saying, but I bought that box of cornflakes. If you want to have breakfast cereal, you've got to buy your own box of cornflakes, darling. You know, husband and wife arguing over something like that. It seemed to be about on that level. However, they persisted, so BBC Two then did another version, reversioned it again. The person that did it, you know, I don't know what he did. Those are the ones you see now, and to start with, they didn't use the improved music, which Mike McCarthy and I noticed that the little bump where they had cut out the two extra lines in the signature song, so that it went, Mr. Brown goes off to town, he comes home each evening, but he's ready with his gun. So who do you think? And it was just a momentary little, so who, just a bit wrong. And so Mike worked on that and made it absolutely perfect again. And to start with, the new BBC Two ones weren't using that SIG tune. So I got in touch with the guy who did it. For heaven's sake, if you do nothing else, please use the improved music, because Mike McCarthy was the original sound supervisor, sound designer, and he's improved it. So please use that. So they did from then on. They also retained my credit on the very last episode. So if you watch Never Too Old, you'll see it does say series editor at the end. Whether that continues, who knows? But it was not my idea. It was David Crofton. He was a bit important to the show and should have an opinion. Interesting question. Have I got a favourite Dad's Army episode? I don't think I have, really, which is strange. The Queen Mother's favourite episode was The Royal Train, with Captain Mannering saying, "Your Majesty, Your Majesty," because obviously he was looking for her husband. And so on her 100th birthday, they said they were going to show Battle of the Giants or something. And I said, no, we can't do that. And you must show The Royal Train, which they did. It's very nice of them to accede to that request. I know that David Croft's favourite episode was Mum's Army. He particularly liked that one. It's so distinctive, wasn't it? With Carmen Silvera as the love interest to Arthur Lowe. It was absolutely wonderful. I like that episode too, but I don't know. I don't think I particularly have a favourite episode. Sergeant Save My Boy, I think was particularly funny, but hey, they were all good, weren't they? I know that Jimmy Perry didn't particularly have a favourite, but he had an unfavourite episode, which I'll share that little secret with you if you don't know. Do you know what it was? No? Well, I will tell you. It was the one with a cricket match, where the platoon was playing a game of cricket against the wardens, and they cheated somewhat by getting Freddie Truman in to come and bowl for them. And Godfrey saved the day. For some reason, Jimmy didn't like that episode. Hello was one of those programmes which became almost addictive. It was fantastically good fun. They made a documentary some years ago and asked if they could interview me about it. And I said yes, went into studio office or something and sat in front of a camera for an hour while somebody asked me lots and lots of questions. And I was getting a bit weary after about 45 or 50 minutes. I said, so what was your general impression of working on the Lower Low? And I said, it's the most fun you can have with your trousers on. Immediately I said that I regretted terribly saying that, because I thought they'll only use one sentence and it'll be that one, won't it? But in the end, fortunately, they didn't use that, which I was very grateful for. But it's somewhere some kind of digitized bit of memory somewhere in the BBC is me coming out with that slightly crass comment. But it was great fun. I mean, it was the biggest laugh, and the cast were just sensational and funny, and still are. We had a 35th anniversary of episode one being transmitted, and put a plaque up in Linford Hall, which was the primary location, and it's to celebrate a blue plaque from the British Comedy Society celebrating 35 years of the Lower Low, and there it stands still in the courtyard where the Café René once stood. But it was enormous fun. Unfortunately, it involved some very late nights after filming, principally in the bar of the hotel, which made for slightly shaky starts in the morning. But I wouldn't have missed it for the world. It was huge fun. Now, Ain't Half Hot Mum, as everybody knows, was one of those programmes which fell out of favour because they thought it wasn't politically correct. The lead character, they all thought was blacking up, as the phrase, in order to purport to be Indian. Strangely, he was the only member of the cast that was actually born in India, because all the supposedly Indian members of the cast were either Bangladeshi or Pakistani. So, and he was actually lived in India until he was 18. So I tried very hard to get the program repeated on many occasions. One little time that happened, I was at a do at the BBC and Alan Yentob was there, and he at the time was controller of BBC Two, I think, or maybe one. So don't correct me on that, because it doesn't matter to the story. Anyway, I went up to him and I said, now how about It Ain't Our Fault, Mum? David Croft and Jimmy Perry wrote marvellous scripts, and you won't find anything funnier on television than the episode The Road to Banu. It's just absolutely hilarious, and brilliant characters in a wonderful setting, and very, very funny. And Mr. Yentov said, oh, well, Lenny Henry's over there. Go and ask him. If he thinks it's all right, we'll do it. So I went over to Lenny Henry and I said, now, Lenny, we've got a problem here. Alan Yentov says he'll only repeat It Ain't Our Fault, Mum, if you say it's all right. And Lenny said, it's a brilliant programme. It's hysterically funny. Doesn't offend anybody. It's just all jolly good fun. I said, tell him yes, on one condition. I said, what? He said, tell him he's got to repeat Chef as well, which was the sitcom that Lenny Henry had been in. So I went back to the other side of the room, back to Alan Yentov, and I said, I've just had a word with Lenny Henry, and he says he thinks it's absolutely wonderful, and it should be repeated. And Alan Yentov looked at me, and I said, yeah, and he wants you to repeat Chef as well. That's part of the bargain. He said, all right, point taken. I knew Alan Yentov reasonably well, because he had actually been my head of department when I was working with Jonathan Miller in Music and Arts Department before he became controller. So he knew who I was, and that was all right. So there was a plan to repeat it, and it was all very exciting. So I worked hard in an edit suite. Again, I seem to spend a lot of my life like a mole in a darkened room. And after much discussion with David Croft, we decided that, he should amalgamate the first two episodes, because they hadn't really got it together in the first series. It wasn't until series two that it really took off. So we worked out how to do that and how to make it into one episode, and I made that and in the edit suite, and I took out all the scenes where the Sergeant Major aims a kick at the punker waller or something like that. Took that out completely. Now, that left a bit of a gap, because you obviously can't go from walking across the parade square into the office and without a TARDIS. So I had to take a scene of him walking up the stairs from another episode and slot it in there so that you could see the whole walk and him going on it. Otherwise he would have jumped and it would have looked ridiculous. So that was quite hard work, and we succeeded in doing that, and showed David the finished result, and he thought it was splendid. And so all steaming ahead, and the BBC had agreed to show a series. And so it was scheduled, and I'd booked all the edit suites ready to do all the rest of the first series, so that we could put together not seven but six episodes to show. And then somebody set off a bomb in a pub in Soho. In the end, they found out that it was absolutely nothing to do with racial violence or anything like that. It was just a madman from Farnborough in Hampshire who set off two bombs. Anyway, they were so worried by that and thought that it might be a racial thing that it was not a good time to put on what they still felt was the provocative It Ain't Our Fault, Mum. And so I got the call through saying, we're not going to do that. Can you do the first series of IDI instead? So I had about 3 weeks to get myself together and clean up the first series of IDI, which I did, and they were transmitted and everybody was very happy. But I have tried and not succeeded to get them to change their minds about It Ain't Our Fault, Mum. And I suppose probably it's all too late now. But I used to get phone calls from Donna Sterling saying, I've been speaking to Windsor and he says it was a very funny programme and they keep repeating Dad's Army, but they never show ours. And I said to Windsor, they ought to do our programme and he agreed. So will you get on, Charles? I keep asking you, but you know, nothing ever happened. Every week for a long time. I'm poised, I'm ready, I can still do it, but they don't ask. They've got my phone number.
I haven't
actually sent Charlotte Moore's now the controller of one, done controller programs at BBC, and I haven't actually sent an email to her since last Tuesday. So I still continue persistently making requests about one thing or another. She knows very well who I am. Now, Urang My Lord was what David Croft always used to describe as the jewel in the crown of their portfolio of programmes. The production values were as good as any costume drama that the BBC or anyone else made at a third of the cost and done in twice the time. Fantastic programme. I didn't work on the pilot. There was somebody else that sort of took my place as production manager on that. And then in between the pilot and doing the first series, the lady in question became pregnant. And so I was unable to continue, much to her annoyance and my delight, because by that time I was available again. And so went to be part of the office again and worked with David and everyone else on Urang My Lord. And marvellous it was too. I helped find locations. It was easy for me because I'd lived up in North Norfolk and my parents were still up there. And I knew a lot of people, so I was able to find locations, as I did on Hello, Hello. We were the first production company ever to film at one of the big houses up there, which, you know the name of it? No, you don't. Okay. Well, there's a stately home up there, Holcombe. Okay. So there's a stately home called Holcombe Hall, which is the seat of the Earl of Leicester, or as we used to know him, Eddie. His son is now the Earl of Leicester, the Cook family. And we were the first people ever to get permission because I knew the Earl of Leicester and his wife, because my father was a retired clergyman and he used to take services in St. Withburga's Church, which is up on the hill, and also in the chapel in Holcombe Hall during the winter months. So knew the Earl of Leicester very well, and I approached him by his agent, land agent, and said, you know, whose name was Fred Jolly, and said, now Fred, we want to, could we come and film on the lake? Won't disturb them, won't be in the house or anything. I said, yes, absolutely. So we had a marvellous time filming on the lake with Kenneth Connor in a little boat poodling up and down the lake. And that's where we had the long distance duck landing on the water. So Holcombe, and lots of people have filmed there ever since because I think they quite enjoyed having us there. So when we came to Urang My Lord, we needed a stately home, but somehow Holcombe was too big. It wasn't appropriate for the Meldrum household, who were not landed gentry. They were sort of just a wealthy family. I mean, he had the rubber company, Union Jack Rubber Company. So he was Lord Meldrum, but he was still ran a business. So it needed something smaller. And so the good Earl and Fred Jolly between them suggested to me that I should go and approach his cousin, who lived in a smaller, still lovely house with big grounds and everything, further along the coast in North Norfolk. And that's where we went. And that was our principal location for Meldrum Hall. And a jolly good time we had too. Marvellous, marvellous time there. And filming all around North Norfolk, which suited David Croft down to the ground because it meant he could go home at night, you see. Okay. Oh, Dr. Beeching was the final sitcom that David Croft wrote and produced. And we started off by making a pilot episode, which was with Sherry Hewson as May Skinner. Sherry at the time was part of the cast of Coronation Street. And David Croft and I went to Manchester and talked to the Coronation Street people and said that we wanted to use her in this particular show, the pilot. And they slightly reluctantly agreed to that. And Sherry came down and took a very short break from the show, and that was all right, all was well. However, when it got to being commissioned as a series, they absolutely refused to release her to do the series, which was extremely mean-minded of them, actually, and stupid, because it wouldn't have made any difference to their program. But nonetheless, they did that. And what was unforgivable was, in the time that she should have been with us, they actually didn't use her for about 6 months. She was effectively not in it. Well, might have been not 6 months, but a period of time she actually didn't appear for a while. And so that was such a childish kind of punishment, if you like, for daring to work for the BBC, that people are a bit more enlightened now. You actually get the stars of ITV programmes appearing on the one show, and they're quite happy to advertise each other's programmes in that way. Back in the day when we were making this in the 1990s, they were not so flexible as that, and there was this terrible rivalry. And fortunately, those producers are now gone, because they've just got ridiculous. So it was recast, and Julia Deakin joined us as May Skinner, and jolly good she was too. So we had the it was sort of almost Heidi High on the Railway, but we had Paul Shane and Sue Pollard and Geoffrey Holland as the three principal characters, with Julia Deakin as Paul Shane's wife in it. Lovely Barbara New, who had been in Urang Milord as poor Mabel. Perry Benson, who'd also been Henry the Boot Boy, came in on the footplate of the railway train, and so it went on. And it was lovely to work on. Now, I know that I'm credited as being production manager. This is because of the intransigence of the person who at the time was the head of the entertainment department at the BBC, who thought that he'd come from Granada and he wanted to try and make the BBC entertainment department like Granada. You know, like, it's like working in a jam factory in the north of England and then trying to take, you know, getting sort of picking up a bigger job in like a sort of General Foods, and thinking you can change it to be like your jam factory, however successful the jam factory was. He didn't last very long, thankfully, but it was at that time it was very awkward, and he said that people who weren't strictly listed as being directors shouldn't be allowed to direct, and they should, and that this, in the old saying, if it ain't bust, don't fix it. He wanted to fix it, so, and in the way that he did it, it all went horribly pear-shaped. And so I actually took redundancy from the BBC, left the BBC, and then came back as producer of O Dr. Beeching. I know it doesn't credit me with being in that position, but I effectively produced it right from the word go. David actually said, well, you have to be named as producer of O Dr. Beeching. You virtually produced Urang Milord whilst being credited as production manager, you know, which was a bit of a strange turnaround. I mean, he was producer, and of course executive producer in a executive producer role, but I did all of the producer kind of jobs, if you like. And so once we got to O Dr. Beeching, we were on location, everything, there I was as producer, the Radio Times Guide to TV Comedy, which is the kind of the Bible of comedy, Mark Lewison, not always totally accurate, but it credits me as being producer for series two, but not for series one, which is patently not true. But there we are. So that's why. And so the actual title that somebody has is not always reflective of exactly what they're doing. It's all a bit. It depends on the internal politics of the department and who's running the show at the time. So, and I feel a bit foul of that. But there we are. It doesn't matter. It was still good fun, and they shouldn't have stopped it because we could have carried on for a long time. And judging by some of the programming, it's going, no, I shan't say that. It was a good program and we loved it.